Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you non-monetized, endorsement-free insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 142, I had the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Ed Ryan of Minneapolis, Minnesota. We discuss device design, the evolution of vitrectomy, and scleral buckling pearls. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Edwin Ryan. Dr. Ryan is a partner, researcher, inventor, and educator at the Vitreoretinal Surgeon PA in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And he's joining us today to talk about his career as well as several topics he's worked on throughout it. Dr. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, it's your first time on the show. For all new guests, we always ask the same question, which was, how did you end up as an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist?
Well, initially, I was going to be a pediatric hematologist and oncologist and was excited by the biology and really depressed by the fact that, you know, in 1980, 40% of the patients died, and got interested in pediatric ophthalmology, transferred from peds to ophthalmology, and about 2 weeks into it, it was pretty clear that retina was where all the interesting stuff was, where all the smart people were, not to get myself in trouble with all those other docs, but it really seemed like that was the place to be.
So let's talk a little bit about your career. So when you first finished your fellowship, initially you were at the University of Minnesota, is that correct?
Yeah, I wanted to do academics and looked at two places, Michigan and Minnesota. And at that time, Minnesota, which was my home state, appeared to be the more stable of the two academic places. And that's where I came.
And then let's talk a little bit about some of the things you've worked on in your career. And the first thing we're going to dive into is the issue of instrument design. So for both as an academician early in your career, and then now in private practice later in your career, talk a little bit about how does one get involved in instrument design? Is this, you know, if a fellow's listening or young attendings listening, talk a little bit about how these ideas came to you. We'll talk a little bit about the stiffening sleeve and also about the guard shielded guard. Tell us a little bit about those two things.
So I designed a tool when I was a resident that a local guy in Chicago, I was at Northwestern, made, and we used it on a cataract case, and it performed a function. I thought, well, this is kind of fun. And when I was a fellow, probably 4 or 5 months into the fellowship, this was, 1987. And bimanual vitrectomy was being done, but the light pipes were not very good, and the illuminated picks were really bad, lots of glare. It was a design that could be improved, and I talked to my staff about a couple of ideas, one for a pick and one for a cannula, and got a guy who had just left Storz in St. Louis to make some prototypes. His name was Greg Scheller, and he went on to start and grow Synergetics and then Catalyst nowadays. And he made a couple of prototypes that were actually quite useful, and that got me started. Those were sold for a while by Grieshaber and got me started developing some instruments. And then when wide-angle viewing came into prominence, which was in the early to mid-90s, Stanley Chang had come out with the Bullet, which was a great light, but it was kind of like holding a naked light bulb in the room. And if there was blood in the vitreous or anything that created some glare, the glare was really disabling. And I came up with a way to, the shielded bullet was a 20 gauge light pipe that was really good at giving panoramic lighting without the glare. And that actually sold for quite a while and made me at least a fair amount of money, which I decided to use for funding any patent applications that I might have that might be useful. Fast forward to about 2002 or three, and the first micro-incisional vitrectomy instruments came out, and they had a lot of flaws. First of all, the entry was poor, the lights were poor, and the instruments were unbelievably flexible. The first week I used them, I thought, well, this is bad. I don't see an advantage to this unless there are some things that could be improved. And I basically got some needles, 22 and 25 gauge needles from the hospital, cut them into, you know, standard length and shorten, and played around with the flexibility of the 25 gauge needle, and it was pretty evident that having some sort of sleeve would improve the stability a whole lot. And the original shaft of the instruments were 33 millimeters, which is, you know, unnecessarily long in pretty much everybody. So that was an interesting journey. I approached B&L, where the original manufacturers of the small gauge instruments, and got no response. And Alcon had come out with some as well at that time, no response. And it took several years before anything was done. And what was done was Alcon's 25 plus, basically 25 and 27 gauge plus. And 25 plus, I think, is the most commonly used instrumentation worldwide.
Yeah, I mean that was a huge change, because I think a lot of fellows don't realize that 25 predates 23. It just wasn't the 25 that we work with today.
Yeah, the 25 plus behaves like 23 did when that first came out. And when 23 gauge came out, that was the go-to thing, because the 25 gauge was terrible. And I'm glad this is that much better. I think there are things that could be done to make it better. Those are in the future. So anyway, I guess, you know, what would I say to somebody who's interested in design ideas? You have to develop a relationship with somebody, and there are fewer of the smaller companies. It's gotten harder to get things made and into the operating room.
Right.
Since there are increasing barriers. In fact, the barriers are getting ridiculous. It's so much harder to get things made nowadays, and or to get things that are made into the operating room, because there are all these cost warriors who are preventing you from getting access. But be persistent. You know, there are a few companies out there. Vortex is one of them, and Catalyst, Med One. There's a few out there. If you've got something worth talking to someone about, and if you can really convince yourself that it's worth something, you should apply for a patent.
No, that's great advice. You know, that's spin off what you're talking about earlier in terms of gauges. I mean, you're someone who trained in the 20 gauge era, and now we have, you know, multiple options available to us. So if you're doing a vitrectomy, is there a standard gauge that you employ? Do you change a gauge depending on the type of surgery you do? What do you prefer to do in your hands now?
I would say that, well, I looked at this actually not that long ago, and I did one 23 gauge case and like 225 plus. And the 23 gauge was a complicated anterior PVR case where I knew I'd be dissecting. You know, I'll do a hybrid case in the when I have to do a lensectomy. But the vast majority are 25 gauge. And if 27 gauge were stiffer, which it isn't good enough yet, at least in my mind, I'd use that. I do think, again, over a long history, I think the cannulas are a win. I think the fact that they're there reduces the number of peripheral retinal tears and some other complications. And I think that smaller is better when it works.
That's true. Let's spin off of that. And so one of the offshoots of small gauge vitrectomy has been, there is a faction that has said, well, now we're in the era of small gauge vitrectomy. The instruments are great and they work so well. You know, a scleral buckle doesn't have a role anymore in the fixing of retinal detachment. There's people across that spectrum. There's people who say, you know, either a buckle or a vitrectomy, they don't do combined procedures. And there's people who are all the way on one side where they say, you know, buckles shouldn't be done. They don't do any buckles. And I know I'm pre-biasing because I know that you're going to be firmly on a different side of this argument. But what would kind of be your answer if you had a fellow or young attending, you know, come to you and be like, you know, Dr. Ryan, you know, I didn't learn how to do buckles during my fellowship. Is this something important to me? And if I need to learn how to do it and I didn't do it during a fellowship, how am I going to learn how to do it?
Well, that's a real problem for fellowships nowadays. First of all, as you pointed out, there are many opinions, many of them strongly held, not very many of them well backed up. And we haven't had any studies that are good head-to-head type studies, basically since the SPR study, which was predating small gauge vitrectomy. And small gauge vitrectomy, no question about it, is way more comfortable, but it's only more comfortable the first surgery, whereas scleral buckling is uncomfortable, but it's quite often the only surgery. And at least my impression over the last 10 years or so is, you know, I've continued to do these buckles on, certainly on young people, and there's a lot less disagreement about a 30-year-old getting a buckle, especially a 30-year-old who hasn't yet had a PVD. And then the subset of 50-year-olds. And it seemed to me that these 50-year-olds were recovering quickly and had good vision and didn't seem to have many complications, including they didn't progress regarding a cataract because they had no vitrectomy. And I thought, well, we need to compare that. So that was the genesis of the PRO study, and it's PRO meaning primary retinal detachment outcome study. So not thinking that there's any chance we could do a prospective study, there's so many problems with it. Number one being finding surgeons who are skilled in the three different styles. And one of the problems with the SBR is they only looked at vit versus buckle, and whether a vit buckle was done was at the surgeon's discretion. So I wanted to get a huge data set. I wanted to get a setting where we can look at the data set with only preoperative characteristics known to the researchers. So you select out the patients by the preoperative characteristics. You don't know who the surgeon is. You don't know who the or what the surgery was and what the outcome was. So then you've got this basket of cases and you look at what was done. And in the basket of cases, in the thinking subset, we had about, I think it was roughly 25 to 30% were buckles. Vit buckles was actually the largest group, and vit alone was the middle. So 171 buckles, 283 vits, 330 vit buckles, and looked at visual outcomes and anatomic outcomes. And in the phakic group, the buckles and vit buckles had the highest anatomic outcomes at about 92%. Vitrectomy was at 84.3%, which was statistically significantly inferior. And all of those vitrectomies were a microincisional vitrectomy. So, yes, I understand that people are choosing vitrectomy alone, but they should acknowledge that they're having a lower initial success rate. So that sort of had been my gut feeling. Being in a big group and watching, you know, what other people do, we tend to be pretty conservative with vit buccals as well, just because we have a better batting average with that, or at least that was our sense. And it turned out with these five groups that we had, and they're large groups, well-known groups, those are the outcomes that I just quoted. Vitrectomy was statistically inferior.
Yeah, so the spinoff questions, and I'll just make, you know, I think one thing that was very surprising, but I think is nice to see, is that the buccal vit success rate was not lower. And you would think that maybe you're selecting that more complex cases more prone to PVR, but that selection bias did not diminish the success rate of a buccal vit.
Well, one of the study design plans was to try to, as much as possible, limit it to a subset of cases that was similar. So there was a little bit of a bias for larger detachments to be done with the vit buccal, but there were many other cases that were excluded that got a vit buccal because they had some PVR and they had some other risk factors. So this was relatively straightforward cases, and vit buccal did much better. If you looked at everybody, vit buccal continued to be much better than vitrectomy.
Right.
So even with the more difficult cases, vit buccal did pretty well.
So this has been shown, this is a great, great study, but this is not the first study to show that the success rate of phakic vitrectomy for a primary retinal detachment in terms of primary reattachment may be lower than a buccal or a buccal vit. I mean, it's been shown various percentages over the years, but it's been shown and discussed before. So as with someone with much more experience, my question is twofold. First is why, and we all have theories in this, but why is this true? And the second is, are there situations where you will do a phakic vitrectomy? And this is something I struggle with because I had attendings and fellowship who would do phakic vitrectomies. I attended fellowship who would limit it to older patients who weren't, you know, younger in their 40s and 50s or 30s, but maybe in their 70s or 80s. And then I had attendings who simply wouldn't view every phakic RD as a buccal, and maybe you do a vitrectomy, but they at least merited a buccal. So these are kind of two separate questions, but what are your thoughts on those two issues?
Well, I'm not an ideologue about it. I mean, if somebody has a localized detachment, single flap tear, lots of vitreous hemorrhage, one thing that will, you know, if somebody's got a fairly dense vitreous hemorrhage, they're going to get a vitrectomy. If they've got a single break or something that's, you know, pretty limited, you see on ultrasound, well, I don't know that you need to do a vit buccal. And so there are settings where I think that a vitrectomy alone is appropriate. Some of it, I think, has to do with experience. And one of the things we're going to look at, and I haven't gotten a chance to do that yet, is there a different rate of success depending on how many years out of training the surgeon is? And it may be a bell-shaped curve, you know, where it goes up and then it starts to drift down. I don't know. We're going to look at that. I think that may be an interesting question. But I would say, in my mind, a phakic patient who's got a clear lens is a buccal. And a phakic patient who, unless there's something, you know, like fairly significant PVR or vitreous hemorrhage or something like that, in that setting, it's a vit buccal in my hands. Pseudophakic patients, that's a little bit of a different question. But for phakic patients, I lean towards buccal or buccal vit, and vitrectomy is not vanishingly rare, but pretty uncommon.
So going back to the original, so there are some fellows, unfortunately, who just aren't exposed to either a lot or even any buccals during the fellowship, whether it's in the setting of a buccal vit or in the setting of a primary buccal, which is very different than doing a buccal vitrectomy. In terms of, though some of the steps are the same, it's very different in terms of the approach to the buccal. So if someone has not been exposed to that much to buccaling, do you have any tips on someone who, if they wanted to incorporate this, they're seeing this data and they're like, you know, I need to do this to be the best possible surgeon I can be. So if I'm ready for that scenario, What are some tips for buckling you'd give to fellows? So, are there certain bands or elements that you lean towards that are easier for someone to adapt to? How do you implement a buckle and decide on height in a buckle bit versus a straight buckle, for example?
So, yeah, it's so incorporated into my thinking. It's I hardly have to think about it. Just because I've done so many for so many years. So I use a 41 band almost all the time for a buckle. And if there's an irregular break or some large break, I may use an element or a sponge. But the band that I use, if I'm using a band, which is most of the time, is a 41. And in this study, there were five different bands that people chose to use. 240, 40, 41, 42, and 40, 50, I think they were. And and everybody has their own individual argument for it, but I think a 41 is small enough, it's not difficult to work with, and yet it's a little larger than a 240 and might cover some things that might not have been covered. And I tend to, well, I mark the brakes. You have to be able to, identify and mark the brakes and be comfortable with that. And the band goes at the anterior edge of the band is near the posterior edge of the brake. So that might be a millimeter or two at the most behind the anterior edge of the buckle. And I use belt loops. I wouldn't be doing that as an initial surgeon. Sutures would probably be better in that setting. Belt loops work better in my hands. I mean, they're faster. And I tend to pull up the buckle so that is just approximate to the globe, and then do drainage. And I drain much more often than I don't. And then I pull up the band about 8 millimeters, and that's kind of the standard for buckling for me. And the key is position of the band, identifying and treating all the breaks, draining the retina fairly flat. I usually put in an SF6 bubble, and that generally is a successful procedure. Interestingly, I was just talking to our fellow about one of the subsets, which is phakic macula off detachment, had a 96% success rate with scleral buckling. That was the highest of any subgroup.
Yeah, I mean that again. The argument, and I think that anecdotally, in a much fewer cohort of cases, I would say that I've seen that to be true. I would say the only argument from opposition would be that there may be some selection bias, but I think that definitely. I mean, I guess it's, and again, you can comment. I think I've very rarely seen really nasty PVR after a straight buckle. I'm sure it is possible and it
Yeah.
does happen, but you don't see it to the same degree in my limited experience compared to yours as you do after a vitrectomy.
Well, we found that. That's been my impression as well. In fact, it's kind of a old dictum that a failed buckle is a vit, and a failed vitrectomy is who knows what. I mean, the people who never do a buckle do a repeat vitrectomy, and then they get more PVR, and they do a repeat vitrectomy and retinectomy, and it's kind of this cascading series of events. Whereas if you do a buckle and it fails for a myriad of reasons, it's a pretty simple case to just do a vitrectomy. You don't have to even modify the buckle 90% of the time. So it's pretty true, I think, that scleral buckling is, despite the people who argue against it, saying how brutalizing it is, and showing a bloody external photograph. Well, yeah, I guess on the outside of the eye, on the inside of the eye, it's totally atraumatic.
That's true. How do you like to drain?
I drain, and this I published this in archives a little while ago. Oh, and another aside is ophthalmicedge.org as surgical teaching videos. And I've got two, one on scleral buckling and one on doing a vit buckle. And the vit buckle is from a few years ago. It's a 20 gauge case that tells me I need to update it because I use 25. Even though I've done a vit buckle, I like the cannula. The way I drain is make this standard cut down. And just before I'm going to, and I put a suture to close it up after I've completed the drainage. Before I do the puncture of the choroid, I put the indirect on, do the puncture, switch sides, and watch with the indirect the retina flattening as I'm draining fluid. And I see a lot of it rather than just looking externally. The advantages are you can see an impending incarceration. You can see whether there's bleeding. And if there is either one of those two, you can use the cotton tipped applicator that you're using to depress the eye to compress the drain site and stop the process. If there's bleeding, you put the depressor over the drain site and push hard and the bleeding stops. So there are a lot of advantages to that technique. And, you know, one of the arguments made for vitrectomy versus buckling is that the drainage is quote unquote uncontrolled. Well, here's a way that drainage is very controlled. And I do that quite a lot. And I haven't had submacular hemorrhage of any degree. Actually, I haven't had submacular hemorrhage for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years or something. It's a pretty controlled technique.
And with that technique, again, this is something I think that if you don't do a lot of buckles, you get uncomfortable with the idea of retained subretinal fluid, because I think if you're doing mostly vitrectomies, there is probably some retained subretinal fluid, but you just don't see it as much clinically. And if you do a buckle or you do a pneumatic, for example, you will have some retained subretinal fluid and you're kind of relying on the RPE. And if you haven't relied on the RPE before, then your faith can be a little tested because you just don't have the experience to rely on that. So how when you're, for example, buckling with a fellow, how dry do you like to see the retina? Are you, is it just that you like to see your breaks opposed, or for like a macula involving detachment, you really want to make sure the macula reattaches? Do you do anything special to try to make sure that happens?
On a buckle, I would say no. I mean, if the break is closed, and I'm not such a purist that if I see the break appropriately placed on the buckle, I think, well, that's all we need, even if there's some fluid. If I like drain, buckle, gas. So basically, it's like an enhanced pneumatic in a way. And I think that the buckle and the bubble are terrific vice grips, basically, for the break. And you can still have, a moderate amount of subretinal fluid, and that's gone the next day. Or maybe in a few days, there are settings where you're going to see subretinal fluid for a long time. You know, some 26-year-old who's had a detachment for 7 years, drain it or not, it's going to take forever for the rest of that to go away. But you just have to be comfortable with that. And doing a vitrectomy in that setting is a disaster.
Unnecessary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I in one day I saw two women, one who was 25, had a macula off detachment. I did a buckle. She had been 2070. She was 2020, about a month out. That was 22 years ago. She just came in because she thought she ought to get looked at because it had been 20 years. And she had one change of glasses. She was 20/20. She was a psychiatrist. The second patient was 28 and had surgery elsewhere. She had bilateral detachments, 20/30 and 20/20. Barely macula off in the 20/30 eye. Bilateral vitrectomies with oil. She moved to Minnesota to go to a school for the blind.
Wow. That's terrible.
And I fixed her hand motion detachment. And so now she's 2200 OU. And that's not going to change. And that is I looked at, I got the pre-op drawings and looked at all that, and I thought, I do two buckles and she gets a different prescription,
yeah.
You know, for her contacts or whatever. Nothing ever else would happen. So, you know, there's a subset where the people who advocate for vitrectomy only are completely wrong. And I'm 63 now, I don't have any cataract, if I had a detachment, I'd want a buckle.
That's, I think, the most telling, is that what people would want for themselves if they were in that scenario.
Well, you have some local knowledge there.
Well, we're going to switch away from surgery just to finish up. And the last thing we're going to talk about, which you've researched and you've spoken about, is the TZD. So the TZDs are a class of drugs used for diabetes mellitus type 2, the thiazolidine and diazepam. I always have problems saying the whole thing. And I think patients are on less and less of these for multiple reasons. Actos, Avandia are two of the more famous ones, the brand names. And there were safety concerns outside of ophthalmology and reasons why they were removed, because there may have been some issues with edema and some other side effects. But you were one of the people to talk about the side effects in the eye with diabetic macular edema. So tell us a little bit about that.
So this was early 2000s, like maybe 99, 2000. I started seeing patients who had macular edema that was just way out of proportion to their other diabetic findings. And they, you know, if you've gotten blood hemorrhages and this massive edema, didn't make sense. And, you know, I asked about their systemic situation. Well, yeah, my A1C is the best it's ever been. And yet they could barely walk. And a couple of them had gained 40 or 50 pounds of mostly fluid, but not only fluid. And I thought, well, gee, I wonder if there's a connection here. So I ran into at my son's baseball game, an endocrinologist at the University of Minnesota. I told him about this. Told him about the two drugs. One was Actos, the other was Avandia. And he said, I hate those drugs. Keep your eye on this. So I had five very well-documented cases, wrote them up, submitted it to the New England Journal, and it wasn't accepted. And submitted to the ASRS, I think it might have been called the Vitreous Society, I think, they may have had a combined meeting with the Retina Society in New York. That's where I presented it in 2003. And actually, by that time, I'd alerted my partners, and we collected, I think, 31 cases that were pretty convincing. And our catchment area is probably 5 million people, so it's not a huge number. And of the 5 million people, you know, if you look at population statistics, 1 million of them have diabetes probably. So it's not a super common thing. And I presented this, and within a week, I'd gotten three phone calls. One was from SmithKline Glaxo that made Avandia, about an hour and a half conversation. And everybody who had an MD got a letter from them saying that this was a risk. So I thought they handled that very well. Second phone call was Takeda, which makes Actos. And that was about a 1 minute conversation where the person on the other line said, you can't prove that. And that was it. And the third, which was interesting, and the third conversation was with a woman from the FDA. That was about an hour and a half. And she asked me many, many questions. And I said, gee, you know, I had this well-documented report that got rejected by the New England Journal. She said, well, they're big advertisers. And I thought, wow, I don't want to hear that. Anyway, 2 years later, there's a newspaper article in the Wall Street Journal about a scandal at the FDA. Two women resigned over suppression of data regarding these drugs, specifically Avandia. And it was the cardiac-related events that got Avandia taken off the market. It's no longer available. And one of her quotes was, I'd had a long conversation with an ophthalmologist who made a pretty persuasive case for these, possible systemic problems. And when the cardiac reports came in, she took them seriously. Well, that had to be me. And so that little observation indirectly helped get a drug, $2 billion a year, by the way, drug taken off the market. Actos is still being sold, but you're right, it's being used less and less and less. And it's probably the other systemic things. They put on a lot of weight, they retained fluid. It made their A1C look good, but made everything else not so good.
Well, that's a great story showing a lot of different issues that come with the medical intersection with the pharmaceutical industry and very different approaches by two different companies. So, well, Dr. Ryan, thanks much. We ran way over, but I really appreciate you and our listeners will appreciate hearing from you. So thank you again for joining us from Minnesota, and we'll let you continue with your evening and your evening activities. And we'll talk to you again soon, hopefully.
Thank you, Jay.
Have a wonderful night. Thank you.
Good night.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINApodcast.com. All 142 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. And on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. There are links to subscribe in the iTunes store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section, the Apple Podcast Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can always contact us by clicking on our website or emailing us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love episode ideas, feedback on things we can do better, and things we are already doing well. And we appreciate everyone who's left reviews in the Apple Podcast and Google Play stores. And please continue to leave positive comments in the form of reviews there. We are starting a new submission opportunity for those of you who do have a question or comment you want to be aired on the show. So please use the members app on your iPhone or equivalent app on your Android or Google phone and send us an MP4 of your audio question to retinapodcast@gmail.com, and we may use it during one of our episodes. Many thanks to Dr. Ryan for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Amanda Casa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Finally, thank you listeners for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversation you inspire here. This is Jay Schreather signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the car.